So to anchor what I think will be a quite wide-ranging discussion of the topic of American politics, today's seminar is in a kind of author and editor meets critics format based on a soon forthcoming book from Cambridge University Press called American Political Economy. I've got a chapter in the volume, and Jacob, who's going to kick us off, is one of the four editors. So Professor Jacob Hacker is editor and contributor to this volume. He's the Stanley Riesel Professor of Political Science at Yale and author of numerous highly influential books on American politics, both in the slightly nerdy academic variety of my personal favorite, but also in the much more popular vein. As you can see over his shoulder, his most recent book, Let Them Eat Tweets, I think I would recommend to anyone interested in US politics, not just the political science nuts like myself. I'm an associate professor at UCL. I specialize in comparative political economy of kind of rich Western democracies, including the US and peer and comparator countries. So that's the blue corner. And then in the red corner, hopefully not too swinging critics, Professor Des King, the Andrew W. Mellon Professor of Government at Oxford. And it's a real treat for you all tonight because Des is another world expert on American politics, on American political development, and his most recent book, I think most recent, unless he's been writing extra ones that I haven't read yet, Fed Power, also really straddles the themes of democracy and capitalism, which are our focus tonight. And last, but almost certainly not least, we have Edward Luce, who is the US national editor and columnist at the Financial Times, former Washington DC bureau chief, and also the author of two recent books on American politics and other rich Western democracies, The Retreat of Liberalism and Time to Start Thinking, America in the Age of Dissent. So what's gonna happen is Jacob will kick us off speaking for about 20 minutes. Des will give, and then Ed and myself will give a kind of initial discussion and response, and we'll have a bit of a conversation there, and then we'll open up to the Q&A. So with that, thank you all again for coming, and let me give the floor to Jacob to talk about American capitalism and American democracy, or American political economy, as we sometimes call it.
Great, thank you so much. Let me put my screen up. Can I have a thumbs up from somebody that they can see the screen? Okay, wonderful. So first of all, I'm so pleased to be here on behalf of this entire group. That you can see up on the editor's list. And I should say that it was a little disconcerting when Lucy said we'd be here till 8 p.m. because for me, it's 2 p.m. in the afternoon. But of course, I know that we are, we've chosen a time that works on both sides of the pond. And I'll try to keep my remarks very brief so that we can have a conversation, because this is an enormously distinguished group to speak to. And I'm really grateful to Edward and Desmond, Ed and Des, as I'll call them, for their willingness to play this role. So maybe, I'm not sure, but this might be the first edited volume that you've featured in this series. And I recognize that edited volumes have a bad rap. As Lucy said, you know, there's the stimulating popular books, and then the deeply erudite, but maybe not as stimulating academic books. Edited volumes would be like one level lower on the rung of reach and readability. But this is actually a really stimulating edited volume, and not just because Lucy's in it. It is a book that represents a project, if you will, that the four of us have undertaken with the support of the Hewlett Foundation. And so I'd hesitate to call it a manifesto, but I think it is aiming to be an agenda-setting contribution. And the goal that this volume has is to articulate a vision of a new field within American politics research, or within the discipline of political science more generally, but we're really focusing on work on American politics. And I will try to limit the kind of internal critique of American politics research, in part because DES has done so much to make it as well, and in part because I doubt that that's your primary concern. But I do really want to emphasize that the reason that we wrote this volume and the reason we brought together such a stellar group of people to do it is that we want to change the way in which scholars of American politics think about what they're doing and what they're and in particular that change the range of things that they're studying and the types of explanations that they're offering. Now, that may be of less interest to you than the question of what's the payoff of having a field of American political economy. And a core claim that we want to make is that that the payoffs are really large, not just for the field, but for the ability of political science to contribute to some of the most important discussions that are taking place in our society today. Political economy, as I will argue, is a substantively oriented project. It's trying to tackle big questions about the relationship between capitalism and democracy. And it is an engaged project, right? It's trying to do so in a way that can produce insights that can then be carried into political and policy discussions, not necessarily by those doing the scholarship, but by a range of actors who can draw on that scholarship. So I list here some of the key questions I'll take up. And I just want to highlight that after sort of articulating what we're up to and talking a little bit about some of the findings, arguments we make, that I really do want to come back to this question of how should people who are not as fascinated by the American political economy as I am, how should they understand what they can learn from thinking more broadly about what's happening within the borders that surround me today? Okay, so as an area of study, political economy really describes the intersection of markets and government. And the tradition of political economy that we're drawing on is really the tradition of work in what's sometimes called comparative political economy on the relationship between capitalism and democracy in rich and relatively stably democratized countries. And that's not to say that there isn't a broader scope for political economy beyond rich capitalist democracies, but as the United States is one, for now at least, it's definitely capitalist, but the democracy is in trouble for reasons I'll articulate. As the United States is one, the kinds of comparisons that really enrich this discussion are ones that occur within the universe of rich capitalist democracies. And again, the debt of this work to a prior body of scholarship on comparative political economy is really profound. And Lucy's in this work, and so she knows well that the kind of central finding of comparative political economy is that capitalism is not of a piece, right? Nor for that matter, is democracy or economic governance. There is huge variation across rich democracies in some fundamental policies and social and economic outcomes. Obviously, one that is front and center in many people's minds today is inequality. So the United States, as you all know, has really quite high levels of inequality, particularly very high levels of income concentration at the very top. And the work of Piketty and Saez and Gabriel Zuckman and others, particularly through the World Inequality Database, has really charted how much inequality differs across rich capitalist democracies. So if you group together the countries of Western Europe, you see a trend towards a gradually rising inequality, with the top 1% pulling away from the bottom 50%. But you can see here that trend is much, much more dramatic in the United States, right? So there, in the US, the top 1% has seen its share of income essentially double over the last 30 years or so, whereas the bottom half of Americans have seen their income fall by about half. And so the position of these two groups have essentially reversed. So that's just one way to think about it. There's something something special, not necessarily special in a good way, about the American political economy. So as I said, we can't understand American politics without understanding the American political economy. And by that, I mean, not just that we need to pay attention to the substantive policies and the political contestation that's behind patterns like the one I just showed you, but that we need a scholarship on American politics that's attentive to those kinds of factors that comparative political economy has emphasized distinctively: the role of particular institutional configurations, the way in which electoral and governing institutions and institutions in the private sector that link organized economic interests with policymakers, the way in which those institutional configurations mediate cleavages in society, patterns of economic production, and patterns of political conflict that in turn, political distributional conflict that in turn shape economic governance. And a central part of the comparative political economy project and our project is thinking about the coalitional patterns that lie behind these kinds of mediating interactions. So, the study of American politics, as I'll say in a little more in a moment, about which I'll say a little more in a moment, is really focused on the dyadic relationship between voters and politicians. Comparative political economy cares about that, and maybe more than in the past, but it really is also attentive to the coalitions, particularly of organized economic actors and their relationship to parties that shape how voter preferences, how voter interests get embodied in the representative process. The final point is that that the comparative political economy project and our project is really attentive to the fact that what we see today is a result of a long-term developmental process. And that this means more than just history matters. It means that there are strong elements of path dependence in contemporary political economic arrangements, and then in particular, it means that past political contestation and power relationships are embedded in contemporary political economic arrangements. We may not see those as power relationships because they have become institutionalized and taken for granted, but they powerfully can constrict the agenda and who has an advantage or not in shaping it. So we just wrote a piece for the Annual Review of Political Science, and in coming up with it, we tried to come up with a term that would capture kind of what these elements of an approach contain. And we came up with the idea, or Kathy Thielen came up with the idea, of metapolitics, right? So much of American political science is focused on what might be called mass politics, on voters and elections and the way in which they might condition policymaking. We're really focused on the kind of long period that leads up to that mass politics, the institution shaping, the agenda setting, the venue shopping. And Kathy also had this nice way of putting it, where she said, you know, as in supply chain logistics, right? We're more interested in the long journey than we are in the last mile. So there's a lot of focus on last mile politics, but we're really interested in the steps that lead up to that. When you do that, I think you come to, or at least we come to, three kind of conclusions about three kind of central features of the American political economy that are both relatively distinctive and highly consequential. And I'll just list them here, and then I want to pull them out just a little bit and then talk about some of the payoffs of focusing on them. So the first is that the level of institutional fragmentation and the degree to which it is not just fragmentation horizontally, like across branches of government or between the across branches of government, like the courts, Congress, the presidency, but also vertical across levels of government, all the way down to very important local political processes. That is a really striking feature of the American polity. And it's closely linked to another, which is the extent to which racial cleavages, you know, race is constitutive of are constitutive of the American political economy. And then finally, we really want to say that one of the key features of the American political economy that links up with these two others is the way in which the economic interest environment and the coalitions that it produces are very distinctive from what you might see or what you often see in other rich capitalist democracies. So on the institutional landscape, we have a figure in the book that I've tried to boil down here on the number of veto players in the American political system. And just suffice it to say, there are a lot. It's very hard to get things done. There's a strong status quo bias. And interestingly, that kind of fragmentation coexists with another feature of the American political system that I think is maybe less remarked upon, which is we are a really, really strongly two-party system. I think that's partly because of the role of the contest for the single office of the presidency, but even there are lots of countries that have like 2.5 party systems. I would put the UK in that context. The US has a two-party system. Third parties, as Richard Hofstadter once said, sting and die. And they often don't even get to sting before they die. And two-partyism has a lot of impacts, I think, on the way in which political economic conflict plays out. So you have a combination of two-partyism, which is increasingly polarized and nationalized, and a highly fragmented status quo biased political system. And it's a system that, and this is why I wanted to mention parties, is embedded in a highly decentralized structure, and not just of governance, but of elections, the translation of voter sentiments into policy. And so in addition to the status quo bias, as you can see in this figure here, right, the decentralization of the system also embodies some very strong, non-metro or anti-metro biases as well. And that, of course, has a strong racial component as well. So there are two sides to this, and you can see them both in the context of race. So on the one hand, you have a system that is essentially embodies these long-standing racial inequalities that have been embedded into institutions, including the institutions of public policy, like our highly racially bifurcated welfare state, in which there is a set of means-tested benefits, often at the discretion of the states, that are much more likely to be associated with non-white Americans as beneficiaries. And on the other hand, there's also a kind of private structure of social provision that I've written about through the workplace, where privileged, higher income people are much more likely to have strong benefits, and where those who do not have such privileges are often dependent upon their own limited wealth and or highly episodic and kind of weak benefit structures that can disappear when they lose their job, as we saw during the pandemic. And the decentralized structure of this in terms of race and class segregation really is laid bare by the structures of local governance and are embedded in the structures of local governance, as Des and others have written. And so we have this figure here is just to give you a sense that some of the very crucial policies that affect opportunity and that in particular are important for the well-being and chances of upward mobility of those of non-white people who are lower on the economic ladder, those are predominantly local concerns where there is enormous variation because there is so little done relative to what you see in other countries to try to equalize resources and power across these divided jurisdictions. And I will not belabor this obvious point, but I don't think you can understand the depth of racial disadvantage in the United States without understanding how the carceral state in the US has grown up through through this highly decentralized structure in which policing and prosecution are really local responsibilities, but of course where we also have this strong element of punitiveness embodied in national policy as well. So the last of the three points that I mentioned up front were fragmented economic organizations. And because I'm definitely running low on time, I just want to briefly mention them and then make a few broader observations. So we see in the context of the pandemic, I think, the degree to which our economy has essentially become one where we both have very, very weak labor. You can see that in the black line here. And note that it's weaker than it looks here because there's so little bargaining by labor that actually extends across multiple employers, but also where we have weak employer organization. That is to say, there is very little scope for the kind of coordination that you might see, as we saw during the pandemic, with voluntary policies to try to allow workers to be able to stay at home during the pandemic, but still remain connected to their employers. In the US, that totally failed, and the structure was basically centered around the traditional kind of strategy of laying people off during an economic crisis. And the fact is that this fragmentation of the employer world, the lack of opportunities for coordination creates a very narrow, particularistic kind of business community. One that is advantaged in part because it's able to move from venue to venue, particularly using the courts in our multi-venue polity. And it's also true that these interests really operate in the market as well as in politics as powerful actors. And so you can't but think about the consolidation of our tech world, right, as a kind of key example of that. And so, you know, the tech motto is move fast and break things. In the United States, you have a narrow structure for organized economic interest in which it's often to their advantage to act unilaterally rather than to try to move into more collective action modes. And because these sectors are increasingly consolidated, as we've seen in meatpacking recently, and we know in the tech world, they're often able to act unilaterally. One of the interesting essays we have, and I'll just move to the essays real quick, is actually about how this operates in the financial sector, where Ben Braun argues that there's this kind of infrastructural power that asset managers have because they've so expanded their reach. The large asset managers now, the big three essentially control the lion's share of asset holdings today. So in our book, we have contributions from Lucy, but I wanted to mention just a few. And one is that there's this really nice piece that Nate Kelly and Jana Morgan do on how national level gridlock is central to the growth of inequality in the United States. I mentioned the sort of role of race class segregation, and Trounstein has a wonderful chapter on that. You know, have to mention the let them eat tweets type argument, along with Jake Grumbach. Paul Pearson and I have a piece on the way in which the Republican Party is a kind of distinctive right-wing populist party that combines fealty to plutocratic priorities of corporate interests and with a kind of right-wing ethno-nationalist backlash that is very much reliant on the territorial basis of representation. That means that it's basically drawing its support from declining areas of the country that are predominantly white and have had their discontent channeled into a form of extreme anti-immigrant and anti-Black backlash. And all of this, I think it's important to say, have posed real threats to a kind of capitalist model that is based on the production of knowledge and with investments of the sort that Lucy writes about in her chapter in research and development, infrastructure, and so on. And of course, that is, of course, the central debate that's taking place today is whether we can overcome those threats and whether or not we can reverse the threats to democracy that are posed by the increasing radicalization of this plutocratic populist Republican Party. So with that, I want to stop. I said I would say a few words about how this links up to comparativism, comparative political economy, but I'll hold off and hopefully that'll come up in the context of the questions. Thanks so much, and I'll look forward to hearing from Des and Ed.
Great, and so with that, I will not waste your time, but pass directly over to Des. I don't know if you have slides to share or if you just want to take the floor.
No slides, thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you very much indeed for this opportunity and for the panel and organizing and for the great book. I'm just going to try and present a couple of points and we'll go from there. So this is an important and stimulating new framework about American political economy with three elements: multi-venue governance, which is federalism, distinctive interest organization, which is really a consequence of federalism, and the recognition of systemic racial divisions. There's an excellent introductory framework, which has informed Jacob's presentation, and some terrific chapters on such subjects as asset manager capitalism, material racial inequality, innovation, and the red states. This is going to be influential and important, and people will want to buy it and read it. But let me turn to some comments to simulate a discussion. And I'm going to focus quite a lot on race in my comments, but not entirely. I've got three broad comments. First is about my concern that the racial division is sort of third rather than as constitutive of the framework. And I think it just has to go deeper. Racial inequality and black-white disparities are a deliberate and purposeful consequence of why, not just how, the American state was established and the way the American state now operates. And I think this fundamental point, while there's a great deal about it in the introduction of the book, is still slightly underplayed. For example, I mean, just to begin with the core, the reason for the US is what the editors call the US, they say, has an unusually high decentralization in its federalism. Yes, it does. It's quite distinct and unique, as they show with the tables. And the reason for this can be found very straightforwardly in the pro-enslavement motives of the delegates who met in Philadelphia and produced the document now called the Constitution. And I think furthermore, the distinctive interplay amongst organized groups, which is the second element, explains neither how racialized this interaction is, this interplay, nor why civil and voting rights reformers have not been able to use it as effectively as other groups. And we'll come back to this in a little bit. So I think I so much welcome the historical perspective, the recognition of interest, the developmental framework, but I still would like to see greater centrality of the racialization of the constitutive element of the American state and the way it was created. And I will say more about that in a minute. But that's the first broad comment. And I think terms like opportunity hoarding, and scholars in Europe often talk about the ethnic penalty, just doesn't excise the racist logic at work. It doesn't tell us enough about what's involved in these things. And there's a danger of simply describing rather than explaining the phenomenon. My second broad area is I'm afraid, to challenge the novelty and to say how distinct is this and whether we're neglecting some other traditions. There's some reference to Shanat Snyder in the introduction, but I think there is a tradition that comes from E. Shanat Snyder, from Charles Lindbloom, that probably needs amplifying in the study. I think if Charles Lindbloom, who was a political scientist, I think he's deceased, he was at Yale, Jake will know.
Amazingly, he is, since I ran the Institution for Social and Policy Studies, which he had was one of the key leaders of. And at last I heard, he is still alive and kicking in New Mexico. My assistant has stayed in close touch with him. My favorite quote from him is that if he were to do it over, he would read less political science and become a better dancer,
right,
for what it's worth.
Thank you for that. I know, and actually Rogers, who's here, told me he's still with us. So Lynn Bloom wrote a book called Politics and Markets and talked about the privileged position of business in the United States. And I think if Lynn Bloom were to read this volume, the introduction, it would be rather like Molière thinking, I've been speaking prose all my life. He would say, I've been speaking this American political economy all my life. I'm surprised others are only catching on now. And this privileged position of business helps us understand some of the themes in the book about post-industrialism and the innovation economy. We really have to, you can't understand the skewed pattern of innovation, the urban systems and so forth that you referred to, without paying account to such institutions as zoning, which one of the chapters does do, and you've mentioned in your introduction. But we need to think also about predatory credit practices, the way in which whole communities have been deliberately exploited and misled. We have to think about the issue of for-profit tertiary institutions, which are fundamentally operate in fundamentally racist ways. That is for-profit, not non-profit universities, but for-profit ones. Or how public schools in the major metropolitan areas no longer have more than 10 and 15% white pupils. They're performing a different sort of function. These are the background to the innovation community and to the privileged position of business. Schaff Snyder, a very, very famous political scientist who some of you may or may not know, spoke about the heavenly voice of the choir and the organization of political interests in America to buy us well off. I think this is a background influential. This points to another area of political economy, which I think is also influential and important. And this is really how much capitalism is racialized. And we need to think about Cedric Robinson's classic book, Black Marxism, showing how capitalism and racism did not break from the older order, but rather evolved to produce this modern world system of racial capitalism, dependent on slavery, violence, imperialism, genocide, and so forth. Eric Williams's book on slavery and capitalism. Or more recently in the American context, Edward Batiste's really very exciting book, The Half Has Never Been Told, in which the subtitle is Slavery in the Making of the Modern American Capitalism, which exposes how enslavement was fundamental to the making of the American political economy, underlines the violence underpinning the US's political economy. And I think violence is a topic which is neglected in this collection, and the extent to which financialization on Wall Street grew in tandem with, indeed rested upon, the Southern slave economy. Baptiste also notes, tends to issues of intersectionality in American political development, showing the tripart exploitation of enslaved women, cotton crops, and productivity. If you don't know this book, you can consult it by looking at a disgraceful anonymous review in The Economist when it came out a few years ago, which the magazine then had to apologize for and withdraw. The volume, this collection, The American Political Economy, Jacob's collection with his colleagues, is of course stronger on the post-Civil War inheritance and the diffusion of racial segregation in the century up to the 1970s. But curiously, I could find no reference in the volume, and I haven't read it as closely as I ought to, and I'm looking forward to taking it home later tonight to do that. I found no reference to the wages of whiteness in explaining these developments. And this is a classic term introduced by Du Bois to talk about how labor markets operate in the States, and they still continue to. It was formalized by David Roediger. You can't really understand American political development, it seems to me, without digging fully into these patterns. They're still with us. The consequences, the legacies are still with us. Violence and racial capitalism endures. Think about the incarceration regime, which Jacob has just talked about. That slide's not in the introduction, is it? Did I miss it on the prison?
It's discussed, but the slide is not used. So yeah,
okay, so yeah. That was a very helpful slide. So I didn't see it, but the incarceration regime is really quite important to America's political economy at the moment. And interestingly, as Jacob remarked, this is a federal, principally a federal consequence, not so much state and local. And it's generating a new reparations agenda. The last tradition, which I think we might want to spend more time on, is the ideological right in America. Hayek's influence, I wondered where Hayek was, and especially Milton Friedman and his intellectual influence. We know from recent studies, how racist motives fuse into the free market ideology, espoused by the Chicago School, for example, in the design of education vouchers. And we know how the deregulatory agenda of this Chicago School was so important to weakening organized labor and to empowering business, the organized interest that you spend a lot of time talking about. Producers' interests are advantage in the United States. I mean, unions have to be thought about here very much because they so brutally resisted equality measures, even in the 1970s and 80s. And in the era of deindustrialization, then that fell on Black workers in particular. Public sector unions have discovered diversity of membership in the workforce, but that's not true of some of the other ones. And we have a very insightful chapter from one of the co-authors, Hertel Fernandez, one of the co-editors, sorry. This chapter and the description in several chapters of the rise of the Chicago School and the purposeful institutionalization of a malicious conservative legal tradition ignores how both were responses to the civil rights achievements of the 1960s, in my view, from my analysis, from my thinking about it. Ideology was a tool, the ideology of legal conservatism was a tool to revive racial harmony. Let me then come to my third point. Lucy would be glad to know, I'm moving along. I want to do something which probably is a bit odd, but I want to talk about just the emphasize distinctness and institutional distinctness and talk about very briefly two institutions. One is the Fed, the Federal Reserve, and which features a little bit in the volume, but I think probably not enough. There are a few references to it, and you quite rightly praise it in the conclusion for responding to the pandemic. But I think it's reached a really quite exciting stage of legitimation crisis, and it's going to occupy students of APE into the future American political economy. So at the moment, the Fed takes interest payments on its holdings of Treasury and US-backed securities and gives these as remittances to the Treasury. At the moment, Fed remittances to the Treasury are covering 25% of the annual interest on the federal national debt. So there's a kind of circularity here, which is absolutely really weird and interesting. So the Fed owns one quarter of federal debt held by the public on which the Treasury must pay interest. So if it raises its interest rate, i.e. pays more on the several trillion dollars that it keeps on deposit from banks, it's going to pay less to the Treasury and the national debt. This is a really intriguing issue, I think, an important question that we face. And at this very moment, as if in perfect timing, the Biden administration nominates Saul Omarova from Cornell Law School to be controller of the currency. This is a very exciting nomination. Controller of the currency is responsible for regulating banks, but works very closely with the Fed. And of course, she has proposed the idea that ordinary citizens should be able to put money in the Fed. At the same time, we have the current president of the Atlantic Fed demanding that the Fed's policy should include a performance indicator for racial inequality and identity and identify measures to tackle it. This is against the background of revelations about two presidents of who are on the FOMC, and the vice chair, it's ethically very curious, engaging in stock trading. So there's a legitimation crisis for this Fed. It's very distinct. It is a unique institution, and it probably merits deeper investigation by the courts. The other thing is the Supreme Court, and there's an excellent chapter on this in the book by Raman and Thielem. Now, we have to understand the court in the context of the American state and going back to the constitutive elements and the way it was designed. Because there is such a limited state in the classic Weberian sense, that is, there isn't a European state that we think of in the German, British, French, etc., power devolves to judges and to judicial decision-making. This is the realm in which state power lies. For example, for uncomplicated racist motives, the delegates in Philadelphia decided not to have a federal franchise. So quite distinct from all other democracies, there is not a national register of voters. Rather, they left decisions about eligibility to vote to be a state decision, i.e. the 50 states decides who can vote in their states, and all election law, but not all election law, but the majority of it is at the state level. The continuing consequence of this are seen in constant state voter suppression laws, which wind their way up to the Supreme Court, an institution which is now a purely ideological forum, with its decisions determined by a conservative-liberal balance and not by jurisprudence. Both Shelby, the decision in 2013, and upholding Texas's restrictive laws open the gates to imitators. The fascinating chapter by Raman and Thielen understudies, I think, or underestimates the racial purposes of the judiciary, which obviously also informs the way the court favors businesses, as these two scholars convincingly argue. The court does play an outside role, as they suggest, but this is as much in respect to maintaining America's racial hierarchies as it is to maintaining preferences for businesses. They talk about the very influential Powell memo, which inspired the embrace of business by the court since the 1970s, but this has been a powerful force in diluting civil rights, which has profound implications for the electorate and for political economy. And I think needs more discussion. So Citizens United is here, which is a key case opening up the possibility really for bottomless campaign contribution finance, and that has revolutionized voting, but not fundraising, but there's no reference to the Shelby decision, which declared the Voting Rights Act or a significant section of it to be unconstitutional. It's an extraordinary behavior.
Yes, apologies for the interruption. I am going to have to ask you to wrap up, if you would, if you have a concluding remark. I'm sure we'll get back to you in dialogue. But
So just to finish, I was going to refer to my most recent book, which you overlooked, Lucy, but I'll leave that out. So on conclusion, what do we get from APE for the incredible agenda we face at the moment in the United States? We've got a post-Black Lives Matter world with incarceration and reparations as key issues. We've got post-pandemic levels of income inequality and health outcomes. And we have massive diversity challenges in the knowledge economy. In Silicon Valley, I think it's 4% of the workforce is African-American. So it's tiny. So the issues that this volume addresses are crucial and central. And I'm very grateful to the editors for putting it together.
And despite my cutting you off, we're very, very grateful for your thoughts and comments and reactions. I'm sure Jacob will have a lot to say, but I will, and we'll have give you some time to do that, but also take in some questions and provocations from our other panelists. Edward Luce, if you would like to go ahead.
Thanks, Lucy, and thanks, Jacob and Des. I will, Lucy, give you a sigh of relief by saying I will keep my remarks short and journalistic, and I haven't prepared anything, not because I haven't read most of this book, and as Des points out, I've read enough to want to finish this, but because I'm a non-scholar on this panel, and scholars have a way of presenting remarks and responding to presentations that just don't come naturally to me journalistically. So let me give you two or three thoughts. The first, slightly in contrast to what Des has just said, although coming from a much less immersive, grounded background, is that I do find it quite refreshing to have this focus on political economy. You know, whether it's American political economy, comparative international, is less important to me than the breaking down of silos and addressing how the world really is, than these somewhat otherworldly specializations in Congress or the courts, sort of rather abstract but artificial barriers that you have between disciplines in political science that I think has really impoverished the discipline as a whole. And so, you know, as a journalist who's sort of covering these day-to-day actors, going up to Capitol Hill, traveling on planes with presidential candidates and so on, I do my best to keep up with the academic literature. And it's this kind of academic literature, and it's this spirit of this approach that Jacob outlined that I'm most drawn to, because it reflects, you know, the real power dynamics of how the world and how America actually works. That being said, I take Des's point. Others have done it, but not enough. Let me make two points, two very general, fairly high altitude points of my reaction to these essays. My first is a question. Now, Jacob, in your chapter on the red states, and then in other parts of the book, you deal with what I think is sort of the core political question of the United States, is how is it that a party, the Republican Party, with plutocratic policies, that represents very faithfully via Mitch McConnell and others the business interests of America's business and moneyed elites, how does it manage to get the chief victims, the chief white victims of this economy, voting for it so consistently and so obviously against their economic interests? And you do a very good job, and as you do in your book, Let Them Eat Tweets, a wonderful title, you do a very good job of explaining, you know, the uniqueness of this, that, you know, to have populism and plutocracy in one party is a very American exceptionalist phenomenon. Elsewhere with different political systems, it tends to be more fragmented. Plutopopulism is, of course, a wonderful word. But you don't explain, and this is a question that I really, really badly want answered or addressed more directly, and I'm not alone in this, why the Democrats are so bad at combining a recognition of the racial disparities and injustices and violence, as Des pointed out, that are embedded within American capitalism, with the pragmatic need to build class coalitions, to have a genuine emerging democratic majority. They're very bad at doing this. And we do have, and I'm sure both Jacob and Des and Lucy will, in one way or another, you know, be experiencing this quite a lot. We do have an elite cultural left that is attempting to actually make that more difficult all the time, perhaps unintentionally, in fact, almost certainly unintentionally, but to make it more difficult. And I'll just give one upcoming example. If Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate in the gubernatorial Virginia election, loses next month, in 10 days from now, to Glenn Youngkin, the semi-Trumpian Republican candidate, it will largely be because of the impact of culture politics. At the school district level in particular. So the question of why is the left so disorganized, that old joke about Democrats, becomes a very pressing one, and one that, you know, I'd like to see you address within the framework that enables you to address it, that you've laid out. My second and final high altitude point is about the Constitution. Now, you do, of course, mention it in the Supreme Court and so forth, as Des just highlighted. But I think that the limiting role of the Constitution that prevents America from bending so that it won't break, is becoming more and more late 1850s-like as time goes on. The fact that 41 senators representing 10% of America's population can block any change, including a strengthening of the right to vote, including a charter for people to be able to vote, pushback on voter suppression, and indeed on election outcome hijacking, which is an increasingly pernicious feature of the American landscape, that it's almost impossible to imagine that filibuster being abolished. And if it were, it'll be reinstated. The difficulty of adjusting this constitution, of getting 3/4 of states to approve of any constitutional amendment, means that this is going to continue as it is. What you've described, the dynamic over the last generation or so of American inequality and of distempers and of worse in this political system, there is no end in sight. So the system isn't going to bend because the Constitution prevents it from bending. And those states that are given outsized representation, that are given a veto in this system with so many veto points, are never going to vote. They're not turkeys that are going to vote for Christmas or Thanksgiving. So that late 1850s sort of dimension to this sort of brings me to, you know, my second question to you is, assuming there isn't suddenly some kumbaya moment in America, which is just a rhetorical preface. Sorry, my daughter is texting. I have to turn that thing off. How does this morph? How does this progress, this story? Is late 1850s the wrong parallel? Because it increasingly feels like that to me as the right parallel. Those are my two points, but congratulations on the book. And I've already learned a lot from it, and I'm greatly anticipating learning more.
Thank you so much. So a lot of really, really thoughtful.
Thank you both.
Really, really thoughtful comments there. And I do want to give Jacob some right to respond, partly because it's the comments really, really deserve it. But Jacob, we will have questions. There are some questions in the queue. So if you can go back to that bird's eye view that Ed was giving to respond in a concise manner, that would be great. And in the meantime, I'm also going to just lob in a question of my own, which hopefully will be comprehensible, even as I keep it short, which is that I think in the book, in the volume as a whole, there's some more emphasis on this, but certainly in your presentation today, it was, to me, slightly conspicuously absent, which is, this is very much I'm a comparative political economy person, we do this all the time, but this is very much a domestic institutions type story that doesn't pay a lot of attention to the US position within the global context, which is also a political economy. But, you know, does the global power maybe matter more, especially for the long voyage that you're talking about, than maybe the domestic institutional focus of the way that I certainly think about it, but I think is also reflected in the volume as a whole, kind of gives credit for. So take that one or leave that one. I just wanted to throw it in there.
I can take that one right away and say, yes, I mean, when somebody puts, when you put together when you're trying to put together a volume that's this capacious, it's still striking the number of things that end up getting left out. So I just want to start by saying that we very clearly early on said we just need to have more on the international political economic dimensions of this and the role it plays, and we need to have more on monetary policy and the Fed, and we just didn't have the space, which isn't an excuse. It's just to say that we are aware of that. I think the Fed. So I will say one possible way to kind of at least, I don't know if we're buying indulgences or just acknowledging it and trying to get it incorporated into the framework as people pick up this mantle, is that in our piece, the annual review piece, we identify work on the special role of the Fed in a kind of what Jonas Pontison has called a kind of consumption driven political economy is really fundamental, and the way in which the Fed can operate because of the reserve currency status of the United States is really powerful. And those numbers that Des put out are just striking and really suggestive, especially given the degree to which we've seen the system bending and almost breaking, as Ed was saying, the way the Fed has acted in this crisis, which has had enormously unequal consequences, but is also had the result of keeping the economy afloat, that has been a big story that I think we didn't really highlight enough. But I want to stick to some of the other. I want to talk about some of the errors of commission rather than omission. But I don't think they're errors. But I really do like the question. So I do think, and in the annual review piece, we talk a lot more about the literature on racial capitalism. I think we're struggling to figure out exactly how to bring race in, because we want to make two points. One is that absolutely that racist motives and continuing racial backlash are just a fundamental part of American politics to a degree that is hard to find precedent in other political contexts today, at least other rich democratic contexts. And at the same time, we think that there's not been enough attention to the way in which all these structures are racialized in ways that aren't always recognized as such. And that's where I think we're kind of in agreement, and we may be not saying enough about the role of ongoing racism and too much about the degree to which these are embedded in the structures. But I do think maybe opportunity hoarding isn't the right word, but it's a paradox that speaks to this problem of the Democrats I'll get to in just a second. It's a paradox that there's lots of really, really committed liberals on racial issues who nonetheless will join in the anti-development local coalition to prevent the development of affordable housing. I often joke that it's one thing to have a Black Lives Matter sign on your lawn. It's another to have a system of local zoning that allows Black people to actually live in your neighborhood. The other thing I would say is I think the constitutional story, as you say, it's of course race is shot through in the Constitution, and some of those racial elements have been eliminated, but many of them are just structurally embedded. However, I think the Constitution's, it's the interaction of the Constitution with some of these contemporary trends that Ed was talking about that are so fundamental to our political predicament. For example, right, the filibuster is not in the Constitution, right? But if you couple it with a Senate that is so tilted towards non-urban America, and then a party that is using racial appeals to non-urban America to stay in power, right? Then you start to see a system in which this constitutional feature coupled with this practice is deeply inimical to both good economic performance and a healthy democracy. I think Shelby is very much part of the same story as Citizens United. I think the degree to which the Republican Party is at the heart is so committed to anti-majoritarian, counter-majoritarian, or even minoritarian approach is tied up with the political economic side of the story that we tell, that we focus on more. So Ed's two questions. I think I'm going to pass on the first one, in that I do think, I mean, the book is a lot more about this question of why it is that the party is so. That's not your first question. Your first question is why the Dems are so bad. I want to take up that question. So I just want to say that, and this will be my last comment because I really want to, and I might tie in Jared's question here. I do want to say that. That the Democrats are bad, not for just strategic reasons, right? That they're just bad at strategy. They're bad because A, they're deeply disadvantaged by the status quo and anti-metro biases of the system. And this I think is the part that that Paul and I have been drawing out in our continuing work that's inspired by this framework. And because they represent a coalition, an uneasy coalition of, in the same way that the Republicans represent an uneasy coalition of the winners in the knowledge economy, mostly white and highly educated, relatively affluent, and those who are more marginalized by it, mostly not white, you can see this in two ways that I think are really important. One is the degree to which, as you rightly say, Ed, that the party has really struggled to come up with a compelling class-based economic program. I mean, look at how the Build Back Better is the biggest thing that the Democrats could ever really envision doing. And think of how inarticulate the party has been about what that represents. And I think I can explain what's going on beneath it, but it's just really striking to me. And the other example, which I think is an absence in the national agenda, is the extent to which the central crisis for many of the voters within the Democratic coalition, namely the inability to afford housing, is not even really on the national agenda. What is the first thing that's going to get dropped or has already probably been dropped from Build Back Better? It's attempts to try to reckon with this problem, which is a problem of local control, deeply tied up with the kind of racial dynamics that Des was talking about, and is causing an enormous amount of hardship in the same way that the Republicans' fealty to corporate interests is causing hardship among its core voters. So to me, that's and one of the things that I think you really can see then is that both the Republican and the Democratic coalition are constituted in part by this locally based voting coalition that is nonetheless nonetheless is not seeing its economic priorities reflected in the National Party coalition to anything like the extent that you would expect, given how much the two parties have come to rely on different kinds of places and different kinds of people to stay in power.
Well, thank you. If we have time, I'll go back to Des and Ed, and you can follow up with the things that Jacob sidestepped. Before we get to that, I do want to allow some of our audience members to raise their questions. And the first one on the list comes from Cheng Chi. So Abby, if you want to do your magic, and then Cheng, you can go ahead and ask your question.
Sorry, they're no longer here.
Oh, no longer here. Okay, so I'll put this one just because I think it is interesting. And Jacob, maybe your answer is, oh, this is one of those international questions, and yes, it's important, but we bracketed that. But Cheng asked whether the differences between the inequality trajectories that you showed at the very beginning of your presentation could be caused by wealth flowing to America from Europe. I was interested to hear the question put, to hear the mechanism that was in mind behind it, whether that's in the form of rich people moving or just capital moving, or how that works. But I mean, yeah, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I could say very briefly, the data I was showing was on income inequality, but of course, American wealth inequality is very high. I think that the primary place in which this manifests itself as a kind of international story is with regard to the rise of a certain kind of investment in corporate structure, a culture and structure in the United States. And I guess, you know, we really say at the beginning of the book that there's this great paradox where you have these highly successfully corporate entities spinning off profits that have been hitherto unseen in world history, to the most privileged class at the very top that we've ever seen. And yet the overall economy, of course, is working very poorly. And a lot of those, I think that kind of paradox can be explained by that combination of fragmented economic organization and institutional structure that really privileges private market actors unilaterally, seizing rents, if you will, you know, seizing above market returns through consolidation and other strategies, and that involves this like heavy and poisonous dose of racism on top of that, that both keeps a pro-corporate party in power and hinders the construction of cross-class coalitions. So like, I would say that corporations are stateless in a certain sense, right? And we know that there's some efforts to try to deal with the fact that they want to locate themselves only in places that have ridiculously low corporate tax rates. But that's not really, the reality is that American capitalism is the vanguard, if you will, of global capitalism, particularly in key sectors. And yet that kind of capitalism is actually not that rooted in American economic success or in economic success for the middle class. And I think we're trying to explain why that is, and in particular, why it could be that you have more and more of a kind of knowledge economic success story in the US, where we're bleeding away many of the policies and institutions that were central to the creation of that successful knowledge economy, whether it be the ability of kids to complete college, or the investments in research and development that built the knowledge economy. I guess the only thing you'd say, we're still really good at overspending on healthcare, which is great for biotech. But other than that, I think David Soskus has a great chapter in the volume that shows that the anti-rural I mean, anti-urban, anti-metro, and status quo biases of the system are increasingly at odds with success in a knowledge economy.
Cool. And Jared, if Jared is still here, you can push Jacob as to whether he saw your question, but on the Build Back Better bill, but I don't know if he answered it. So do you want to go ahead and re-articulate or push further?
Yes, thanks. Thanks, Lucy. And thanks, Jacob, for the fantastic, I'm really looking forward to this book. I don't think it's out yet. I missed the beginning of this, the presentation, but I've seen you talk about it now for a few years. So I'm really looking forward to getting a copy of it.
I'm really looking forward to it being out too. It should be out soon.
Okay, great. I just would love to get your kind of current reflections. And again, you saw my question, I typed it out, but just my current reflections on, or your current reflections on the reconciliation bill, the Build Back Better, whatever you want to call it. But there's obviously this political bargaining going on. And I think for a moment, I was almost naive to think that it would actually be passed. And like you said, this is the sort of, it encapsulates so many key Democratic policies that Democrats have been talking about for a very long time, and also I think policies that would really push forward a more sort of equal and sustainable economic development path. And so how do we explain this this complete falling? I mean, it just seems like everything is falling apart. And so I study climate change, and now all the key climate provisions have been stripped from the bill, which I guess shouldn't surprise me given what's happened in the US over the past 20 or 30 years. But it just seems how things can go off the rails so quickly. And then the prescription, I don't know if you saw today, the prescription, the ability of the federal government to negotiate prices with pharmaceutical companies over Medicare costs. Now that's apparently out of the bill. And so does the new book shed light on this? I mean, I have some my own sort of hypotheses about, you know, obviously in West Virginia and Arizona, there are very tight margins. Manchin's facing a very tight margin, so is Sinema. And so they're obviously very upset or worried about their electoral fates. Companies have been counter-mobilizing, and there has been a backlash, especially against the climate provisions. But I'll stop and just be curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, I mean, I think you've actually covered a lot of the important ground and depressing ground. The degree to which so I would just go back to saying, to keep it really simple, the degree to which you have both a status quo and anti-metro bias, and that's embodied in particular in this case in the combination of a Senate weighted towards non-urban states and the filibuster, which, you know, is not relevant in the case of reconciliation, but which is clearly relevant in the other existential challenge the Democrats face, namely passing some kind of serious political reform, in particular a voting rights bill. And so I would say also that the stuff that has been left on the cutting room floor, and I actually, you know, to you'll have, I'd say don't quote me on it, but like quote me on it, because I don't think anybody will care my view, but I think they'll pass something. I just think it's going to be a very pale shadow at best of what was originally on the agenda. But what's been left on the cutting room floor is quite revealingly the areas where either A, that anti-metro and, you know, and a bias has really bites, as in climate policy, and this is in climate policy too, where corporate interests are extremely well capable of exploiting the status quo bias of the system, as in climate policy and pharmaceutical policy. And I already mentioned the fact that some of the key policies that might well have linked together the coalition, the cross-class coalition that is the Democratic Party, more like dealing with the housing crisis, are the ones that also have been substantially jettisoned. So that said, like if Democrats don't pass anything, it's going to be even worse than the pale shadow, right? And so I think the reality is really similar to what Ed said, which is that I think we have a constitutional structure that is coupled with nationalized and polarized parties, and in particular, a radicalized Republican Party that is taking advantage not just of those constitutional features, but also of other embedded features of the system, including the filibuster and this almost, I would say, institutionalized opportunities for racial backlash, right? It's easy to demonize government spending. It's easy to shift things to lower levels where they will be consumed by racial politics. That all has left us at this bending point that could be a breaking point. And what will be the breaking point? I mean, the AP volume is certainly not going to answer that. I mean, the literature on democratic backsliding is probably where you really need to look. But to me, we're very close to that. If maybe the 2022 midterms are the point where we will find the answer to that question, I remain encouraged by one feature of contemporary politics that I think is not by no means reflects anything we've done, but which is but is a feature that is very much highlighted by the volume. And that is this recognition of the degree to which the inequality, economic inequality, is at the heart of some of the deepest challenges we face. And secondarily, that it is this distinctive institutional configuration when coupled with race and organized interest that is now seen as a central challenge. And so that wasn't true, I think, in a decade or two ago, that it was understood that we needed both linked political and economic reform. It's just maybe we're coming to that discovery too late, as your very astute question suggested.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's somewhat demoralizing that the good news story that we're going to leave you to take home at the end of this seminar is that at least we all realize just how bad the bad news story is at this point. And the other piece of good news is that it's not just a political problem. It's not just an economic problem. It is, in fact, a really wicked, complicated problem that intersects those two, oftentimes too siloed. And I think I would really echo Ed's comment of that's something that's really useful coming out of this. But we can now all see just how difficult it is to solve those really pressing problems that this kind of volume and this kind of scholarship aspires to at least comment on and try to move forward on. We are out of time. Thank you so much to Jacob, to Edward, to Des, and thank you to everyone for being here on a Thursday lunchtime or Thursday evening, depending on your time zone, or possibly Friday breakfast.